following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
At Farmers Insurance, we know the sound of a perfect hot air balloon landing. And a less than perfect one. Seen it, covered it. Click for more.
We are farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Underwritten by Farmers Truck Fire Insurance, exchanges and affiliates. Products not available in every state.
My name is Matt Perez.
And my name is Satchel Drakes.
And this is Overworld, where we try to be curious, fail at being smart, and talk about video games at the intersection of art, society, and other stuff.
Hey, Matt.
What's going on?
That was a really good conversation that we had with Gabe Durham. Boss Fight Books has been on my radar for a while with like friends and coworkers, and it was really cool to be able to talk with the founder and just unpack the different perspectives that they've been bringing to the table. For the longest time, I've had a I'm a designer and I love like looking at old design stuff. The history of like design and like contemporary art related to stuff around that is very, very short. And like it there's a lot about that that sort of like dovetails with games. If anybody in podcast land has ever read like Beautiful Losers by Rose Strike Books or Ramblings of a Wannabe Painter, like there are these books that aren't textbooks in a sense that they're not academic, but they're also not like YouTube retrospectives. They kind of sit in the middle where they document these moments and these perspectives and these like creator thoughts just to be able to look back on, to be able to have it as a sort of a part of the pantheon of history, I guess.
Yeah, how I think that's like really valuable, you know, because I just finished Jason Schreier's Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, which tracks the development of like a bunch of games. And that's something that oftentimes you miss out on because a lot of PR and whatnot will cover that up. And you know, we think like, oh, games just come out. But for there to be something now where it's in paper, it's down, it exists, that tracks like the whole process of this and like what went through like putting these things together, you know, I think it's super valuable, especially in games where there's not that much, you know, of far as like documenting the process, the people, and like the experience of playing these games.
But it feels like a Wild West still, and it's cool that people are still finding proper ways to document things. It's because for the longest time, it really does feel like, I don't know, like what are the ways in which we reminisce about just the experience of an old game. We like try to flip through like old gaming magazines. We go to IGN.com, you know what I mean? And might like reread reviews. But the permanence of those things feels so shaky. I guess like a site can go out at any moment, or like a site can go down, like, or get bought over, and we don't always have like archives for those things. So it is really cool to sort of have like a, I don't know. I guess a chronicle of what it was like from the context of what it was like. Sort of almost like a gaming scripture, if you will.
Well, I remember like, I don't know, like AP history in high school. Like you would do these essays called DBQs. They're document-based queries or something like that.
And, oh my gosh, I remember this.
Yeah. And they would give you like five pieces of documents, and they usually be like newspapers and books and opinions from people in this time. And like, it's kind of how we track history, right? And I think it's like really valuable. It's something that's being discussed a lot in the industry right now, is like things are, you can fade away. Like, you know, one of my favorite adventure games growing up was Quest for Glory 5, and I didn't play the other four. And I wanted to get them, but they were only on like floppy disk for a while. And then they went to CD, but then that didn't really work on XP, Windows XP. So it's like they finally, like, not recently, but, you know, in the past few years, like, brought it more to a modern release. But like the fact that like something like that could be lost is a little scary, you know?
100%. Yeah.
And taking a moment to thank our supporters, Amica Insurance, Rocket Mortgage, and Veridesk. You'll hear more about these companies later in the show.
So yeah, like, there's a few books that I've gone through and I like really love them. But another point is that there's so many books, like say on The Clash, like a band, there's so many books on American history, and you get different perspectives and whatnot. But it is like right now, like you said, like kind of like a Wild West, because if there is a book, there's probably like a single book on it, you know? Like there's All Your Bases Are Belong to Us by Harold Goldberg, who covers like a it's like kind of like a straight journalistic take on a few games, not the entire industry as a whole. You know, there's Extra Lives by Tom Bissell, which is like it has that personality in it where he talks about his own experience, but will interview Cliff Bleszinski when he's talking about Gears of War. It's Masters of Doom, which talks about a single game, Doom, and like the two creators of it, John Romero and John Carmack. But then like what's crazy is Nintendo, that whole history, Nintendo and Sega, that rivalry is like a huge, huge deal, because at one point Nintendo owned what, around like 90% of the video game industry until Sega like really came along and like made it a dent with them with Sonic. And we kind of have like one book on it. And it's so funny because it's a divisive book, because it mixes that crazy nonfiction and that history with like fiction elements, where it will like have, you know, it will tell a scene and like have quotes from the people involved. And obviously it's all kind of made up based on like, you know, probably reporting accounts, but that like that's like like I think a lot of people
revisionist
really like
history.
Yeah, it's the thing. It's like a lot of people like it, but it's funny because a lot of people don't like it, and that's one of the one of the pinnacle books on that period. And it's like there's only one really, like there's one or two, but like it's still such like a wide open space.
I completely agree, and I am actually like, more than wanting some kind of like objective, analytical, like once and for all, because we kind of have like, I'm like full of that. I'm over that. Like we have this fight for that in like a journalistic space. We have this fight for that on the playground. We have this like, and we have these academic books that lose people. Like I like the idea of just, rather than having like a once and for all, having as many people as possible using the outlets they can to publish things and like, and put it out there, so that we have like, I don't know, I guess a spectrum of voices to look at to formulate what this kind of video game past has been like, you know, because it is very much like, oftentimes it feels like word of mouth, or like, yeah, word of mouth, specifically mouths coming from like graybeards at game conventions and stuff.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Like having that, there's different shades of experiences is really great, especially in gaming, because, you know, not one person plays the game the same, you know? And I think that's why Boss Fight Books is really cool. That's why we talked to them. We talked to Gabe Durham, who's the editor and founder, and they kind of take, like, they mix history, they mix personal stories and criticism, and, you know, they approach games in a little different way, with a different angle than might not already be out in the ether, you know?
So let's get into the interview and kind of share some of the stuff that we were able to unearth with him.
But first, a quick break. This podcast is brought to you by Amica Auto Home and Life Insurance. When you call Amica, you can expect a different experience, because Amica is all about customer service that goes above and beyond the ordinary. You always get the help you need when you call Amica. Visit meetamica.com/Forbes today.
And this year, the office cubicle turns 50 years old. It hails from an age when work was done on typewriters and smoking at your desk was the norm. Today, employees are expecting more from their workspace. They want flexible and active spaces where they can collaborate and feel energized. Verdesk Active Workspace solutions make it easy to encourage more movement to any workday. Being more active at work, like standing more and sitting less, can help improve your health, boost energy, and increase productivity. Verdesk has a variety of desk solutions that replace traditional office setups, require little to no assembly, and are ready to use in minutes. Plus, Verdesk products are made from commercial-grade materials meant to last a lifetime. They're easy to move or reconfigure as businesses change and grow. You can try Verdesk risk-free for 30 days with free shipping and free returns if you're not satisfied. See it for yourself at Verdesk.com. That's Verdesk.com.
With us right now is Gabe Durham. He's the founder and editor of Boss Fight Books. Gabe, thanks for talking with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So for people unaware, can you describe Boss Fight Books for us?
Cool. Yeah, so Boss Fight Books is a press where each book is dedicated to a single classic video game. All nonfiction. Sometimes we say like a documentary style look at the games, which could mean, you know, so some books are more straight historical. Others are really analytical. Sometimes the author will kind of bring themselves into the story of them playing the game, you know, when they were younger versus now. But whatever it is, each time it just takes a look at a single game and digs really deep into that game.
I know when I found it, I thought of, do you know 33 1/3?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I love those books, and when I saw that it was there was a gaming version of that, I was really excited.
Yeah, and in fact, that really was an inspiration in the beginning, because I was kind of surprised when I had the idea and just started looking around that there wasn't already something like that for games. So that was kind of like the first, that was the genesis of the whole idea was, oh, I can't believe this doesn't exist. Well, you know, what if I made it happen? So,
yeah, I was going to ask like your inspirations, but yeah, I guess that's that should be a big one. Yeah.
Totally.
What are some of the bigger aspects of what you try to sort of log about like a particular game experience?
I think the material itself sort of needs to be generated by, for one thing, what the game is. And you know, games are so different from one another that some really seem to loan themselves to a different approach than another. You know, for instance, we got a book on Galaga, but you can't really dig much into the lore of Galaga or the story of
right, of course.
The way you can with like one of our JRPG deep dive kind of books. So there's that, and then also just kind of like the take that individual author is bringing to it. I prefer to, when I think of these books, is that not each of them is like the definitive book on that game itself, although our Spelunky book probably is the definitive book because it was written by the guy who made Spelunky. But beyond that, it's more like a really like kind of subjective take where like the author gets to explore the game and then hopefully use that as an opportunity to explore other things, you know, around that game as well.
Yeah, how did you come about having that like particular blend where it's like a bit of history, a bit of criticism, and some personal anecdotes?
Well, that's always been a genre that I think is really exciting. So particularly for the years leading up to starting Boss Fight, I was kind of getting into reading a lot in that field of creative nonfiction, where you see these people taking a lot of the tools and stylistic approaches of novelists and great fiction writers and then applying that to nonfiction. And sometimes, you know, they'll get kind of experimental with it or take it in these really interesting and surprising directions. Or often it's that kind of thing where, you know, you think you're kind of focusing on one little thing and then it becomes this prism and you're like, oh, there's so much to talk about. This is actually like just kind of the lens through which I can see the whole world. So, you know, I mean, there's been, you know, people doing that thing for a long time, like, you know, like Truman Capote and Joan Didion and some of these people in the past. And then, you know, like in terms of like what I was really excited about going into it, like Tom Bissell had come out with his book Extra Lives only a couple years or so before we started the press. And I thought that was really cool because he was somebody who was, he was talking a lot about the games and digging deep into that, but then also like the circumstances of him playing them. And then he would also bring in, like, he would talk about, you know, novelists and music and, other art stuff, like in the same breath and create kind of this wider big tent cultural conversation that I think sometimes gets missing in games because, sometimes games writers are really into games, at the expense of everything else. And I think games are really awesome, and I think art is really awesome, and so to like kind of have that wider approach is, yeah, it's really exciting to me. It's what a lot of authors I admire already do, and so like kind of creating that forum to invite people to apply that to this newer art form that there hasn't been, you know, that hasn't been already kind of criticized to death the way there's been so much writing about music and movies and books and other arts that that seemed really exciting to me too, is kind of like we get to be the explorers that help discover what can be done, you know, in this new continent or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really cool. The closest thing that came to mind to experience like that, and it's funny because prior to it, I had seen some friends who were kind of passing around the Spelunky book and stuff like that, and I thought it was really cool that something like that existed. But it wasn't until Camposano put out a director's cut of Firewatch, which is just like this sort of like free explorer where you hear the creators talk about like the extension of their thoughts on particular areas and what it was like – not only what it was like putting it together, but inspirations, different challenges that they came on.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was through that was sort of like a doorway to not only remaining in the worlds that we love so much, because sometimes, you know, it's kind of, we kind of have those credit roll experiences where we just want to stick around, we stay in the theater seat, you know, but also that we can just like get to know things better. Really, I mean, are you familiar with the Idle Thumbs like podcast network?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, like it is really cool going off what you're saying, that to not only have sort of like, it almost feels like the best chronicling we have of games we enjoy almost exclusively belong to the opinions and sort of reactions of journalists. Obviously, we love journalists. But, like, I think it's also cool to sort of have those voices from the people who kind of put in the work and their intent. So that's really cool.
Yeah, and I also think, too, one of the spheres that I wanted to reach in is also, like, outside of gaming. And, you know, some of our writers, this is their first time writing at length or maybe even at all about video games. And I think, you know, I don't want that all the time, because there's some people who, yeah, are already just crushing it writing and thinking a lot about games. And so, like, it's great to give them a forum. And then sometimes, you know, people, when they've played games for a long time, or especially if they've intensively, you know, lived inside of a particular game for, you know, maybe even most of their life, they experience it in a way and using a vocabulary that is maybe more unique to them and might be a little more bereft of the industry speak and the lingo that can sometimes
like inside baseball,
show
yeah.
up in games writing, which some people really like, and then others, you know, maybe more casual fans, or just, you know, people who don't, you know, consider themselves like part of the gaming scene as much, you know, would not like as much. So, yeah. You know, yeah. So for our part, but whoever the writer is, for our part, we try to, you know, just kind of have the target audience member be somebody who really is interested in games, who maybe has played the game in question. But hopefully, if you haven't played the game in question, you could still read the book and get something out of it and not be totally lost. So that's a little harder on some than others, but that's what we're going for anyway.
Mm-hmm. Are the people who are – sorry about that, Matt. Do you find those are the kinds of people who are finding your books? Like, what has sort of like audience reactions been like?
Oh, yeah. Well – there's been, I think I will say that, I was, when I started the press, I sort of had in mind like, well, I suppose that we're going to be at the intersection of games and reading. So maybe about half of our audience will just be general people who are interested in things and read a lot of books. And then half of the people will be gamers and it'll all kind of, you know, and then the Venn diagram will just kind of meet somewhere in the middle. But honestly, I think it's really a lot further on the gamer side in terms of who is actually reading the books. And, you know, looking back, I think that makes total sense. You know, people read books about things that they are already interested in. Yeah. I know. Do that too. So yeah, going into it, versus now, I think I have a little stronger sense of who our readership is. But it's also, you know, really diverse, and some things that people, I notice that there are some of our books that click more with certain kinds of readers, than other readers. I think,
ooh, can you,
I think
dive
all
into
of
that?
Our books
that
have
sounds
been
interesting.
Like the favorite boss fight book to somebody, which I think is really cool. But yeah, certainly like sometimes when an author starts writing from their own perspective and kind of, you know, might like share an anecdote from their lives to, you know, kind of apply it back to the game. There's some people who will just totally shut down and say, I didn't buy this book to hear about you and your childhood, writer. You know, I just want Ouch. To read about the game. And, so sometimes that's like, you know, people are just looking for that deep analysis. Some people really like that autobiographical angle. And then yeah. other people, I think they kind of show up for the history. And I think, all of those views are really valid. Personally, I'm interested in all of it. And I'm also interested in trying not to repeat ourselves too much. So, you know, we're often looking for ways to, you know, tackle games from different perspectives, as we, you know, move forward over time. So if there is a book that, you know, gets at something we haven't quite done before, I get, kind of excited about that. But, honestly, yeah, I mean, on the whole, reader response has been really positive, and I think that's because it's a really self-selective audience. Like, the people who find and try out our books are also the people who are kind of predisposed to enjoy our books. And there's plenty of gamers who would find reading a book about a game, you know, to be a total chore, and they won't pick it up anyway. So it kind of ideally, you kind of have a sense of what you're getting going into it, and that's a little bit easier now than it was when we were just starting the press and didn't really have anything to point to. So now when people say, you know, what's it like, you know, you can kind of say, well, this one's like this and this one's like this, and what do you like? And but
Well, what I think is really great about these kinds of books and what they're bringing to the table is that even if it does kind of tap into an audience that's predisposed to enjoy it, I have to imagine there are so many people who are just finding a new voice to describe why they enjoy what they enjoy. That's just something that's been happening lately across the board that I really love, talking about games from the lens of a creative thing that does things to people. I kind of wanted to hone in a little bit on just like this particular genre of a book, which in my head, it like fits in well. So especially like, I don't know, I guess just being around like YouTube circles fits in with like a much more well-edited, sort of planned out approach to, on a large scale, like from very high level, kind of like retrospectives or sometimes just celebrating particular things about what games do. Like when you started putting together these books, or at least for like formulating like what they were going to do, was there a lot of material to draw from as specifically regarding like books about games and about game design? Like, I'm really curious to know what that space looks like when you started, because I feel like, you know, off the top of my head, if I had to like name books related to games, like if I'm not counting like Prima's Strategy Guide, like maybe one or two Ian Bogost titles comes to mind, and like not everybody thinks about Ian Bogost. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I think there's more now than there was when I started putting the pieces together in 2013. So in some ways, you know, we're kind of seeing a lot of people realizing the potential for that space at once. And so there's a lot of cool stuff happening. And, you know, like Blood, Sweat, and Pixels just came out a few months ago. And, you know, things like that are showing up that, you know, are taking you know, kind of long form writing about game development more seriously and that kind of thing. But yeah, I agree. I mean, that was the surprise to me at the time that really lit a fire under me to actually start the press was I was reading one book and I really enjoyed it, but it was just this really breezy read through kind of the whole history of Nintendo, and we would just dip in, you know, for a couple pages on, say, you know, Super Mario Brothers 3 or whatever. And it felt like there was so much to get into, but we got to move on. We got to move on because that's not what this book is about. This book is about all this other stuff. And it's also about the way money moves and, you know, this. Then Sega showed up and Sonic made a lot of money. then Nintendo said, we're going to get that market share back, and they made a lot of money. And that's actually the stuff that I care the least about. You know, I'm kind of in it for the games rather than like the talk around the games. And often also that approach lends itself to a sense that the history is always just going to be written by the winners. And right. One thing that I also was really excited about going into it was the idea that we would hit a lot of the big tentpole franchise kind of games, but then we could also get into some smaller stuff, maybe some games that didn't get the reception that they deserved, and kind of a critical like reevaluation of something that deserves a little more sunlight. And so that was one of the things that I was reacting against at the time. And then, you know, the other is that I think you see a lot of very intelligent writing about games in the academic space. But I find that the academic voice is really limiting because academic voice tends to obscure truth and obscure understanding, because a big incentive there of an academic writer is to sound smart. So they're using a lot of big words, and they're using some needlessly long sentences, and they're kind of always kind of covering up what they're saying with way too many words. And so I really didn't want to do that. So I kind of wanted the rigor of scholarship and the seriousness of ideas, you know, that you see that, and then usually a more plain spoken, or if not plain spoken, then, you know, stylish kind of language that that I get a lot more excited about, and that I think is kind of the most honest and easy way to communicate ideas.
That's great. Thank you.
I really like that idea of putting down on paper like what it feels like to play the games, because like going back to your point, like I think games almost like lend themselves really well to that, because there is that interactive element, and like I think the Metal Gear Solid book is between Ashley and Anthony Birch, so it's like siblings doing it, and that like reminded me of playing Metal Gear Solid and Half-Life with my brother. So there's like that different element of like, you know, you're not just sitting. Not that there's anything wrong with this, but you're not just sitting and watching something for 2 hours. Like, a game could have a completely different experience between each title, you know?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I got to reference briefly in my Bible Adventures book was there's this guy, I think his name is Jamie Madigan. He was talking about this study that found that our strongest video game-related memories are the ones of us playing games with other people. And so, like, when we get sentimental and nostalgic about all the fun times we had playing games, we're probably actually not getting as nostalgic about the time that you know, just kind of 100%ed that one game on your own, even though if it was really fun in the moment. But you're, like, remembering having this communal experience with your buddy or with your brother or sister or with your parent, you know, and, like, actually kind of bolstered these stronger human ties. And I think that's one of the cool things too about anytime you start talking about art, you start talking about people experiencing art, which especially in video games, because it's interactive. And then when you're doing that, you're just talking about people, and, you know, people are kind of the most interesting thing that you get to write about at all, I think. So
as far as like creating literature in this space, like, do you feel it's important to, I guess, track the history of this industry? It's like, what, 40 years old at this point, so I don't know, like I feel like that might be to have that history to start collecting it, like Satchel said, like go to a bookstore like Barnes and Noble, and like the bookcase is mostly strategy guides, so
right. I think actually the answer is yes, because and that's another thing that maybe has changed more over time for me. I think when I started it, I was a little more excited about kind of seeing what could be done with deep analysis of a game, and, you know, when you really dig in and seeing what's there. And I'm just as excited about that now. But I think there is something to the fact that, you know, even in that time, you know, we're all getting older. people who were making games in the early days are starting to die, and we're kind of watching some opportunities to hear from people about what they did are going away. And so what stories are most worth preserving? What could we learn from people in the 70s, 80s, and 90s who are kind of pioneering a lot of stuff that have since become commonplace? And what are we in danger of losing? And which is why sometimes one of the things I consider when I'm looking at pitches is like, well, okay, how much is already out there about this particular game? What do we all, what has already been discovered, you know? And if something seems like it's kind of been done to death, then it's going to be harder to find a fresher angle on it, and it's going to be harder to make a case for, you know, our book kind of really adding much to the conversation. It's been really interesting to see game preservation itself start to take off in the last few years, and it seems like the preservation of kind of the stories around game creation and the early days of gaming are part of that too.
Yeah,
Do you feel like there's? Oh, sorry, Matt. Please go ahead.
I was gonna say, I just know from experience of writing online, like, it's good to, I think, like paperback, even like just the literal paper is like good to track it, because I've had the experience where like you write for a site and it goes down and it's, you know, unless you saved it, it's gone. And that's like crazy to think of, you know?
I don't know about you. I fall into the trap often of thinking that sites are going to be more permanent than they are. And I think especially, you know, in this last decade or so, I've had that disproven so many times where I try to go back to something, maybe especially if it's something I've written or something like that, and it's just gone. So I think you're right. There's something kind of there's something nice about putting it down in a book and knowing that that book can be on a shelf. And there's also just something like nice about using like a really old form like the book that's just been with us for a long time to, you know, and like dedicate that to something newer like games, where, you know, we get to kind of like, I don't know. Yeah. There's still something really like respectful about the book and like writing a book about something, even like a really long form article online that could be potentially approaching the word count of one of our books. There's something really different about reading that versus like having it bound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going through an old storage storage space at one of the old places I used to live, and I found like this just old box of like official U.S. PlayStation Magazine, PC Gamer stuff, and it was just interesting reading like reviews of, I don't know, at the time, Tony Hawk Pro Skaters like knockoffs, you know, and they're not even that old, and they're just magazines, but it's almost like, oh my gosh, I'm reading about these games in like Greek and Hebrew, you know what I mean? Like, there's something particular about it that even the context of the time and the vocabulary. I totally hear that sentiment around that. That's cool.
Yeah.
And don't you find? I was just gonna say, don't you find too that when you look back at old gaming magazines, it's crazy how many games there are in those that maybe you kind of remember or maybe you've just never heard of in your life. And feel like game preservation is like bringing all the games along with us in the cultural memory, because we do have, you know, kind of remember a lot of old games. But the truth is there were so many games, and most of those are just kind of going to be lost to time. And maybe, you know, a lot of them should be, but it's always,
but it's still fun finding really the small ones. Like, surprising. The PS2 library was ginormous, you know?
It's so big.
You know what question comes to mind for me? I'm curious to know. So, I mean, you kind of talked a little bit about, you know, all the different things that you feel these books are kind of bringing to the table, reviving. I'm curious to know, is there anything about like these books that you feel they're bringing to the table that maybe hasn't been brought before?
That's interesting. I mean, I think some of these particular stories have never been written about at length before, and you know, as somebody who's gotten to spend time with all the books, I've learned a lot about some things that, you know, I'd never even heard of, you know, including, I mean, for instance, our ZZT book, Anna Anthropy's book about Tim Sweeney of Epic Games, his very first game, which was a weird little text-based game where you just play like a smiley face moving around individual screens, you know, shooting dashes at T's and that kind of thing. And then, but hearing about like the robust game editor that was there within the game that created a whole community, and how that story kind of dovetails nicely with the story of people starting to find each other online in the earliest days of the internet on BBSs and then on AOL. I don't think I'd ever read anything quite like it. And, you know, I had a similar experience reading, Derek's book about Spelunky. I don't think I'd ever seen a game developer approach the writing of their own craft that way. You know, I've read about, you know, people talking about how they made their games, but that kind of mix of plain spoken storytelling plus advice plus, you know, just kind of talking through his own logic and problems. I think there's something that felt pretty new to me about that. And but yeah, I mean,
that's cool.
I don't know. I think there are new things and new stories that we're discovering, and hopefully, you know, as time goes on, we will kind of discover or even like stumble upon other new things like that. I don't know. I'm a little hesitant to make like grand statements like we're doing something.
I hear you. Right. Yeah.
Nobody was doing before. What was that?
Yeah. By no means was I like feeding like a marketing, like, well, we're going to innovate the space of the thing. Like,
yeah, well, you know, I mean, we're the shoe, and the scene sucked before we came, and you're welcome. Goodbye.
Drop the mic. That's actually, I don't know, that might be a good place to end on.
yeah. Just end it on where the ship. That's great.
Yeah, Gabe, this has been really great. Like, thanks so much for taking the time. Is there anything you'd like to like add or where people can find you in Boss Fight Books?
Yeah, of course. Well, so you can find out about all the books on bossfightbooks.com and buy books there. Also, you know, we're on Amazon and the Kindle store and stuff like that, and in some physical bookstores. Best place in social media to follow us is our Twitter, which is at BossFightBooks. And we've got a lot of exciting stuff coming out before too long. So Final Fantasy V by Chris Kohler is our most recent one, and then Katamari Damacy by Ellie Hall is coming out next. And we've got our Shovel Knight book also on the horizon, and our NBA Jam book after that. So,
oh my God. That is perfect.
Yeah. It's and that's one, by the way, where Rayan Ali, our author, he was so successful at finding interviews with the creators, but also with like NBA players and with some of the people who were secret characters in the game, like Jazzy Jeff.
Oh, nice. And
Jeff. Oh my God. It's gonna be a really fun one. But so please check us out.
Awesome.
And oh, and also, by the way, we're gonna be at PAX East in April.
Nice.
So yeah, come sweet. See us there too.
I'll definitely come by that booth.
Yeah, please do.
Awesome, Gabe. Well, thanks. Thanks again. This is really great.
This was fun, guys. Thanks.
Great.
Take care.
And coming up, Eric Kane and Paul Tassi talk about the lack of Marvel video games in the wake of Black Panther's success.
But first, a quick break. Support for the Forbes Overworld podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the mortgage company that decided to ask why. Why can't clients get approved in minutes rather than weeks? Why can't they make adjustments to their rate and term in real time? And why can't there be a client-focused technological mortgage revolution? Quicken Loans answered all these questions and more with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Forbes. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
At Farmers Insurance, we know the sound of a perfect hot air balloon landing. And a less than perfect one. Seen it? Covered it. Click for more.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Underwritten by Farmers Truck Fire Insurance, Exchanges, and Affiliates. Products not available in every state.
Hi, I'm Eric Kane.
And I'm Paul Tassi.
And we're sort of fresh off the heels of the Black Panther movie release, which I don't know about you, but I thought that was a really, really good movie.
It's like a mortal sin to say it's not a really good movie. So
well, that's true.
It is, I mean, a very good movie, so I will agree with you.
Yeah, it's not without its problems, but it was a lot of fun. And I remember as I was watching the movie, because this is how my brain works, I was thinking to myself, especially at the beginning, some of those first action scenes, I was thinking, you know, this would be a fun video game. Like I would like to have a Black Panther character who could, you know, do all the things that T'Challa is doing in that movie. And I remember thinking the same thing years ago when Captain America Winter Soldier came out. There's that scene where Captain America like lands on that boat towards the beginning and he's just running forward and like just
wrecking everyone with his shield.
And it's like, that looks like a fun video game. And yet, so here's where we're going with this. There is basically, beyond like Lego and mobile stuff, there's nothing. There's no Marvel games except for like an upcoming Spider-Man game. That's it.
Yeah, the biggest attempt at like an MCU, like Marvel Universe game was pretty much cramming a bunch of MCU people into Marvel versus Capcom.
Yeah.
Which doesn't
count.
Terribly. So yeah, it is kind of bizarre. I was researching this before we talked, and there is that, did you remember that one announcement they made about how Marvel is making an Avengers game at some point with, I think, Crystal Dynamics?
No.
That was announced last year, and we've heard literally nothing about it. So it's probably anywhere from, I don't know, 3 years away still, 2-3 years away.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the only major Marvel game in the pipeline outside of, you know, Sony's Spider-Man. But like in terms of Marvel Cinematic Universe, where they have all these successful movies, you would imagine there would be some way to translate that into a game, but it hasn't happened yet. I guess what are your theories as to why this hasn't taken place?
I wonder if it's just a matter of that they don't really, you know, they've been focusing so much on the movies and they don't really have their toes in any sort of gaming stuff. Like, you know, Disney obviously also owns Star Wars, and they've sort of just pawned all that off onto EA when they closed down LucasArts, when they acquired Lucasfilm. And even there, like we're getting some Star Wars games, but it feels like a real trickle. And Disney just in general feels like they're not really big into the video game market yet. Disney Infinity was closed down last year, or the year before. I can't remember now, but I don't know. I just feel like Disney doesn't really care that much about video games. And I want to say yet, because I feel like video games are a huge business, and I just can't imagine not seeing more of that.
I feel like they've dabbled in them and then it didn't work out the way they thought and just started printing money, so they kind of shied away from it. I will say with Marvel movies, it's interesting because I would wonder about kind of the logistics of planning that. And I think we were talking the other day and we were talking about how there are a lot less, in our last podcast, there are a lot less movie-based video games than there used to be. And there used to be kind of a tie-in game with most major, you know, blockbuster movies that came out were released kind of in the same week or whatever. But the problem is games are getting harder and harder to make and taking more and more time. So I'm trying to think of, like, you know, say you want a Black Panther game. First of all, Marvel had no idea that well, maybe they had some idea, but not a guarantee that Black Panther was going to be some monster movie. But to make a really good Black Panther game, you would have needed, what, at least probably 2 or 3 years of development just on that game alone. Yeah. And, you know, why would you do that instead of a Captain America game or an Iron Man game or a Thor game? And I, with when they release, you know, what, 2 or 3 movies every year, I would imagine it would be hard to kind of sort through and be like, okay, who actually deserves us putting all our eggs to make a game for them? And that's why I think they're just kind of going to do the Avengers eventually and just have this kind of big conglomerate game that probably won't actually tie into the MCU very much, but will be kind of their attempt at this. But it is sort of a weird situation because games are so taxing to make these days, where with Marvel, it's not like they can just pass, you're like, oh, yeah, you have the Star Wars license, kind of like do what you want, like make your own game with Amy Hennig or whatever. And it's a lot kind of more tightly controlled. So I wonder how much that plays into it.
Yeah, I mean, Star Wars is pretty tightly controlled, but I think that all makes sense. You really couldn't be releasing just like small, like licensed games alongside the movies. They are just coming out too quickly. You know, we just had Black Panther. We're about to have the Avengers. Then we've got Ant-Man, the sequel to Ant-Man. And it would be really difficult. But I do think that they've been doing these MCU movies for years and years now. And it is just strange that there isn't a big AAA Avengers game. I mean, it seems like the reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, after a decade, you'd think there'd be at least one major MCU game, and there really just isn't. It's just mobile games. And, like, you know, I have a Marvel mobile game I play, and they did, like, a Black Panther event this month, like, within the game, but, like, that's kind of the extent of the tie-ins. But you would think after a decade, they would have at least kind of made one kind of valiant stab at this, especially because it's such a valuable property. And it so lends itself to video games.
Yeah.
You know, we've had Marvel video games forever, and it seems weird that since Disney kind of acquired Marvel, the Marvel games have just more or less tapered off completely. And I remember growing up, you know, you had like X-Men games and Sega Genesis. You had the original Spider-Man games with the Sam Raimi trilogy that were really good. You had what's the one that's like a brawler that was like kind of top down and it had all the heroes together?
Oh,
I can't remember what that's called, but that was a really good series too. They made a couple of those, and then, but then since the actual MCU came along, there's just almost nothing.
Yeah, and it's weird because the technology has moved along so much also, and you could have really interesting, you know, like open world action games, basically. I mean, you could do a lot with the property. You could have an RPG based around the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You could have just straight up, you know, more of like a side-scrolling action game. I mean, they could do a whole lot with it. It doesn't all have to be huge either. It is sort of strange. And I don't know. I mean, do you see it changing? Like you said, there's that one announcement, but then just crickets.
I have to imagine they're going to just keep investing in platforms that are a lot easier to control, like mobile. Like mobile's just 50 times less work than, you know, making some big AAA console game. I do think that with the Avengers, they kind of realized, you know, we might as well at least give this a shot at some point, but I would not expect them to start doing, I guess, kind of individual games based on individual movies again, because we're so far removed from the time period where that was kind of acceptable, and it barely worked most of the time at the time. So, you know, we have something like Sony Spider-Man coming up, but like, you know, that's not really a Disney thing. It's not going to be tied into the MCU at all. It's just kind of a licensed Spider-Man game, and hopefully it'll be really good, but
looks good.
I do think that's kind of the best we can hope for at this point, which is a bummer, because I'd love to see, like, a Black Panther game set in Wakanda or Korea, in the vein of Arkham Asylum or something like that.
I was going to say that. The Arkham games are a great example of video games that really do right by the property they're working with, you know? I mean, not all of the Arkham games are perfect, but it's a really great series overall. But that's kind of like Spider-Man on the other side of the aisle, because there's not a lot more DC games coming out, even though, you know, you'd imagine Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment would be pumping those things out. Like,
Warner Brothers is kind of scrambling to deal with DC at the moment, I think. I know Rocksteady, the Arkham dev, is making another DC game. I don't think we officially know what it is yet. There's rumors it's like a Superman game or like a Teen Titans game or something, but So I think they are making another DC game. I just don't. I don't know what it is yet.
There was talk of a Suicide Squad game, but that seemed to just sort of fizzle out.
Well, that's not exactly the most valuable brand on Earth right now. So
that's true. You know, a Wonder Woman game would be cool.
Wonder Woman game would be cool. That's an, I mean, that's pretty much very similar to Black Panther. Like how fun that would be to have like an open world Wonder Woman game. But again, yes. I guess that was especially with DC and their current slate of films, that was far from a guaranteed hit for them. So
yeah,
you know, they're gonna sink in 3 years of dev time to a Wonder Woman game. I mean, these superheroes are kind of immortal, so I do think we're gonna see, you know, games trickle out for both Marvel and DC in time. It's just gonna be at a way slower pace than the movies because you know, there's more of an easy blueprint to follow with the movies, where games are kind of even more of an investment, and there's no real clear roadmap as to how to do them right, other than say like Arkham. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a, you know, we can look at, you know, just open world third person action game genre, and you can pretty much put most Marvel or DC heroes into that genre in one state or another, and it would work probably. You know, I don't know. I think that the formula is definitely there. It's interesting just in general with movie properties, because, you know, like back in the day, there were a lot more there were so many Star Wars games for a while, and a lot of them were pretty good, actually.
Most of them were, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and they were popular. I think that they certainly made money. But now we're in this time when the technology's come so far, and yet all we have really, other than mobile games, is the Battlefront. So just like competitive shooters, basically. And, you know, like, there used to be so much more just available, and it's kind of sad because, you know, I'd love to see, you know, it was really sad when Amy Hennig's game was canceled, because I was excited for a Uncharted sort of Star Wars title to come out. That just sounded really cool. But it's like, that's maybe Disney's looking at the history of failed Star Wars games and saying, we don't want to go there with Marvel, you know?
Don't give the license to EA.
But. Yeah. Well, I mean, even the one that LucasArts was working on, what was that? Star Wars,
21. I don't have some numbers.
Like that. Yeah. Some number.
I can't remember.
Supposed to like dark and gritty Star Wars. I was excited about that, but nothing, you know, that's gone.
Yeah.
Now.
This is going to sound like video game snobbish of me, but I think it's almost a little harder to make games with these properties than it is movies, and I get that it's incredibly hard to do a lot of aspects of movies and stuff, but fundamentally they're movies. It's a visual medium. Like, you write a good script, you get good actors, you execute. But gaming, you know, that's like 30% of it, 20% of it, and then the rest you have to also make a really good game around it. And like, you know, this Amy Hennig's canceled Star Wars game, like, I'm guessing probably had a pretty good story, you know, fundamentally, but I'm guessing the problems were making the gameplay actually work.
Yeah.
And I think you run into a lot of these canceled projects and things like that because the game component is what's so hard to execute, whereas the story component may not be either as important or hard to do. I mean, Battlefront 2 had a story mode, and that story was just really bad, but
yeah,
it was still kind of it was a pretty mechanically competent game, and so, you know, that's, other than the loot box thing, it was acceptable. But I think a lot of these other canceled projects are running into serious issues with kind of the game adaptation, even if all this stuff does lend itself to games, which is kind of frustrating, but harder than it looks, I guess.
There's not a lot of big movie franchises that really lend themselves well to video games, which is kind of interesting. And then the ones that do, you hardly see anything. You know, there's, you know, Jurassic Park seems like a natural fit, but there's very few Jurassic Park video games. Although there's one coming up that's like a park simulator.
Should it be a VR game?
No, I think it's just a regular park simulator. Like you build a...
I remember that trailer. Well, it's interesting because I feel like there is just this sort of wall between kind of media and games where even all these properties that would clearly lend themselves to be really great video games if handled correctly, you know, moving past Marvel and Star Wars to, you know, Game of Thrones and Walking Dead, like we've touched on before, like those are just dying to be kind of big budget, you know, sprawling games. But the rights holders are just so kind of concerned with the existing product that, branching into gaming is like a whole kind of unknown territory. And I wonder if they're worried about risking, you know, tainting the brand, which is, again, is why you have The Walking Dead with a bunch of like kind of garbage mobile games.
Yeah.
Cause that's relatively low risk and relatively good revenue too. So, you know, why not just keep doing that?
But hey, Game of Thrones not seeing these big adaptations. I can't believe that there's not more decent Game of Thrones stuff. Cause I mean, imagine like a role-playing game set in old Valyria or something like that. You wouldn't have to touch it. You wouldn't have to use any of the same characters from the show and the books. You wouldn't even have to have like a prequel. It could just be completely divorced from all of that, but still be in that universe, still have that brand and be really interesting. I mean, or you could just do something, you know, during Robert's Rebellion, or there's so many things that could be done with that in the video game world that wouldn't have to really rely on any of the sort of established cast or anything like that. It's such a missed opportunity. All of these are such missed opportunities.
There is a long running rumor that it is possible Bethesda might be doing a Game of Thrones game. I'm not sure how much I believe that, but it's I've been hearing this for a long time, and like I don't know if it'll actually come to pass. But I also heard, was it From Software?
Yeah,
also might be doing a game
from Software.
Like
yeah.
Both of those would be cool in different ways. It's just, I mean, at this point, those games would be out well after the show's even over.
But before The Winds of Winter comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess we'll have spinoffs until the end of time. But so I don't know. Maybe there's still hope for those. But I guess the point of all of this is that gaming just moves at like an incredibly glacial pace, where if like a season of Game of Thrones is delayed for a year, it's like a huge deal on TV. But like if we get a Game of Thrones game like once every 7 years or something, that's like a big deal. Or like, you know, if a Marvel movie isn't coming out every 6 months, people wonder what's wrong. But you just can't do that with games.
No. And you don't have to, though. I really think, especially,
if you did.
Well, yeah, they would be cheap, and I think that, you know, if you came out with a good, solid Avengers game, you know, and then 2 or 3 years later you came out with something else. I mean, they don't have to tie directly to the movies. They could still sort of enrich the lore that's going on in the MCU. It wouldn't be that hard to. I mean, there's gaps between the movies that we don't see, so some of the story could take place earlier or in between.
You also don't have to directly integrate it into the MCU. Like, you can use the characters, but you can be like, okay, guys, this is not canon. Like, we're just going to have fun. Like, and, like, I doubt anyone would, like, throw a fit, but...
Oh, no, I doubt
I don't know
it.
If that's against Marvel's core philosophy.
Well, they don't really tie everything. I mean, there's, you know, the comics don't all tie into the MCU. Like, there's not... Same with, like, you know, over at DC, like, the CW shows don't tie in directly with their movie shows. They don't, you know, they're their movies, not their movie shows. They're movie shows. I'm going to the movie shows. I think that, yeah, they could do totally new stories, and they don't have to use, like, the movie stars for the voice acting or anything like that either.
One DC game we're forgetting did a good job was Injustice. And that was an interesting case because... The whole point of Injustice is that it's this kind of like alternate universe where, you know, Superman's this big villain and all this crazy stuff happens and all the heroes are fighting each other. And that actually, that was such an interesting case because that sparked this like elaborate series of comics that were really good and the games are really good. And that's just really worked out well for kind of all parties. And it has nothing to do with, you know, the DCU or whatever, but
it would be better if it was the DCU though, because that story, that's a way more interesting story than they've been telling in their movies.
Yeah. They kind of ripped bits and pieces of Injustice for the Snyder movies, but not enough to make them good.
Right.
I think they would have been better off just doing a flat adaptation of it in retrospect. But then, I mean, Marvel doesn't really have an Injustice equivalent. Like, as we said, it's, I don't know what their deal is with Capcom, but maybe that's the only fighting game that's allowed is Marvel versus Capcom if they still have those rights, which is incredibly unfortunate given how terrible that's been going.
Yeah.
So hopefully that they can maybe extract themselves from that in the future and figure it out. But yeah, just, I don't know. There's a million genres of games that I would love to play as kind of Marvel heroes, but it's like a long time. Yeah, and X-Men. And now that, I don't know, I don't really even understand what's happening with Fox, but maybe they'll have those rights and they'll make cool X-Men games again, but we'll see.
Well, it appears that Disney will be bringing the X-Men back into the MCU fold, so I guess
no,
probably no
something
video games.
Because you got to enter stage 7 or whatever we're going into now.
I'm so glad Logan was made before Disney got its hands on Fox, though, because I don't think that's a movie that would be made in within
the, yeah, it's a bit of a bummer that Disney is just kind of totally shutting down stuff like that. I guess the exception would be they let something like The Punisher be made, like right. Jessica Jones. I guess that's really far removed from their movies, even if it's quote-unquote the same universe, but that's about the limit of the flexibility they're showing. And yeah, I doubt they would make an R-rated MCU movie anytime soon, but we'll see.
No, I mean, maybe someday. Maybe to kick things back once it starts to slow down, if it ever does.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that would, yeah, a Wolverine game would be fun. You know, do you remember the old comic line, The Age of Apocalypse, X-Men stories? When it's like...
Yeah, bits and pieces.
It's kind of like It's a Wonderful Life if Professor X had never been there to, like, mm-hmm. unite the good mutants. That's a great series. I wish they would make that into movies.
That would be cool.
Or games.
We're kind of running out of X-Men plot lines these days, so maybe.
Yeah, right. Well, all right. So we're left at the end of this podcast, we're left with the sort of same hopelessness that we began it with, which is that probably we are not going to see many of these.
Maybe one Avengers game in 2 or 3 years. That's about it.
Or more Telltale stuff. That seems to be the only licensing that's really going on. We got the Guardians of the Galaxy. We got a Game of Thrones. Walking Dead. They do a lot. But, of course, you know, Telltale.
Fading a bit these days.
Yeah. And you don't get to, like, have fun with action or anything with those games.
Which is kind of the point of most of those franchises.
Right.
So.
Right. All right. Well, yeah. Thanks for listening. If you have any insights into this, let us know on Twitter. And we'll see you guys next week.
See ya.
That's it for this episode of Overworld. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Perez.
And I'm Satchel Drakes. If you'd like to get in touch with us, please reach us at overworld@podcast1. That's O-N-E.com. And also you can reach us on Twitter. My handle is @SatchelDrakes. That's Satchel like a bag with an extra L.
And mine is Matt Ryan Perez. Thanks for listening.
Take care.
Get ready for Legends of Sport with Andrew D. Bernstein. The Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame photographer has hit the podcasting scene. Each Tuesday, starting February 27th, Andy and co-host Jonas Wadler will chat with some of the world's most prestigious athletes of all time. Enjoy stories from life behind the scenes with the most decorated sports photographer in the business. Make sure to subscribe to Legends of Sport with Andrew D. Bernstein, beginning Tuesday, February 27th, exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the brand new Podcast One app.
At Farmers Insurance, we know the sound of a perfect hot air balloon landing and a less than perfect one. Seen it, covered it. Click for more.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Underwritten by Farmers Truck Fire Insurance, exchanges and affiliates. Products not available in every state.
At the border, I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. At the roundtable discussion today in San Antonio, Texas, President Trump heard something he said he never heard before about life along the border.
Many people are dying, and the danger of living here, unless you know exactly what you're doing, is tremendous.
This is Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick.
Where are the people in Washington to stand up for these children, these women, these senior citizens? Where are they? Bring them down. Mr. President, let the Democrats come down to Brooks County. Let them come to any of these ranches. Let them see these bodies. Let them see the skeletons. We have the photographs.
Attorney General William Barr says he thinks spying did occur on Donald Trump's presidential campaign, suggesting the origins of the Russia investigation may have been mishandled. Scientists released the first image ever made of a black hole, revealing a fiery ring of gravity-twisted light swirling around the edge of the abyss. One scientist said science fiction has become science fact. I'm Ed Donahue.